This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, Andy Goddard, the producer here. Before we get into this week's episode, I just wanted to give a quick note to say that this week we did interview Noel Gallagher, so there is a fair bit of swearing across the course of this episode. So if you're listening to this on speakers or in the car and you've got kids around, you might want to save this one for headphones later. Anyway, over to Eddie.
Hi, I'm Eddie Hearn. This is No Passion, No Point.
All right, Eddie, where are we this week?
Well, we are in the spiritual home of boxing. This is York Hall, Bethnal Green. I mean, so far on this little podcast experience, you've travelled and followed me around the world at some of our big shows, Maryland in the MGM Resort Casino, Madison Square Garden. Tonight, we're in York Hall, Bethnal Green. This is spit and sawdust. This is 1,600 people. You see the balcony almost touching the ropes of the ring. This is what we call the bear pit, the lion's den. I used to come down here as a kid, 8, 9, 10 years old, mate. You see everything down here. And by the end of the night, you shouldn't be able to lift your feet up because of all the rubbish stuck to the bottom of it. I mean, it's one of those places. But it has everything. And to a fight fan, this is their favourite venue, honestly. I mean, as weird as it sounds, this is up there for me with Madison Square Garden, because this is really, they call it the spiritual home of boxing, which is a very polite way of saying the roughhouse of boxing. So any fight fan loves coming to York Hall. We are completely sold out here tonight for JD Next Gen, which is like a developmental series for our great young fighters coming through who get the chance to box at prime time in front of a sold out arena to see if they're ready to go on into those bigger arenas.
Who have we got? Who are you excited about?
So we've got Conor Benn, son of the legend Nigel Benn, who is undefeated, but he's really had a very, very sparse amateur career. Not many fights at all. But what he has is the hereditary problem that he's Nigel Benn's son and he loves a tear-up. And he headlines for the first time here tonight. We've got Ted Cheeseman defending his British title against Kieran Conway from Northampton. Really good fight. Craig Richards against Andre Sterling. It's like a South London, bit of a sort of turf war. It's to see who goes on to challenge Joshua Buatsi for the British light heavyweight title. We got Charlie Franken, we've got Shannon Courtney, who's been a bit of a revelation, young female boxer. We've got Otha Jones III, one of our guys from the States, coming over to make his UK debut. So these nights really important to push the young talent through. Now, we love the big fights, don't we? AJ, Dillian White. But ultimately, this is the future of the sport, and we have to give these guys the best chance to progress to those big, massive arenas and stadium fights.
I think one of the things I really respect about all that is that, you know, you just, the last show you did was Madison Square Garden, and your next one, you're not going down like some venue in France or whatever.
It's so important for the young fighters to learn it. The young fighters that we represent are very lucky in the respect that they're getting to tag along to those big nights, but they learn more here than they will ever learn in those big arenas, because when you come out here in front of 1,700 people, like I said, literally hanging off the balcony, you can really lose your shit in that ring, right? Just look at it. It's tiny. Anything can happen. People start screaming and shouting. Sometimes the 10, 12 weeks or even 5, 10 years of work you've put in as a fighter can unravel in front of you when you are literally having a tear-up with a man right there in front of us. So these guys learn anything. The changing rooms, and I'm very sorry to York Hall, which is a place I love with all my heart. The changing rooms, it's an absolute tip for a fighter, right? They're used to Madison Square Garden, O2, but the changing rooms back there, they all will all walk in there tonight and go, oh, this is disgusting. But that's what it's about. It's about learning your craft and learning your trade. Now, when you go and start off, I don't know, as a sprinter, you go and you run your schools and your district schools or some run down track somewhere. Look at Usain Bolt. What do you think? He just turned up at the Olympic Stadium in London every time and had these plush changing rooms and masseuses. No, he ran in a field or a run-down track in Jamaica when he was coming through. You know, acts, music acts. Do you think they played at the O2, you know, Manchester Arena? No, they played at some Kazi local leisure centre. But that's how you learn your trade, and you've got to remember where you come from. And not every fighter gets to experience York Hall. Anthony Joshua boxed here as a pro, and he was like, wow, this is what an experience. Because look at the ring walk. I mean, the ring walk's there. The ring's there. What's that? 20 yards. But what, you got to walk through all the people in the bar with beer everywhere and shut up, you. So, you know, we have to really appreciate these nights just as much as we do the mega nights that are beamed all over the world.
Well, that brings us quite neatly on to our guest this week, doesn't it? Someone who almost definitely scraps it out in leisure centres and bars and crap places in Manchester, but also ended up here at York Hall releasing his last album with High Flying Birds.
Well, Noel Gallagher. I mean, really, we called this No Passion, No Point, but you kind of forget how passionate these people actually are. And the common denominator to success in terms of the people we're talking to is passion. You know, we said about Noel, why are you still doing this? Why do the Rolling Stones do this? I thought his answer on that kind of stuff was amazing. We love it. We absolutely love it. Rooney, same thing. Wayne, what are you doing out in Washington? I just love playing football. That's quite refreshing. In a world that's driven by money and sometimes greed and people trying to get you to do this and do that, these guys are actually, their success is driven by their passion. And I love these stories about how Oasis was formed. You know, I love these stories about the touring. Just loved it, absolutely loved it. And I actually left the interview thinking, oh, that was quality. And I hope all you people out there enjoy it as well.
We'll be back at York Hall after the interview, but now here's what happened when Eddie met Noel Gallagher in a little red dining room in Soho House in the middle of London. Now, Noel's team were kind enough to let us use some of the music from his new EP, so you'll be hearing that throughout the show, including now. Just a quick reminder, there is strong language throughout this episode from the very start. Now, on with the podcast.
Bit of lunch in here after.
Is it this way?
Yeah, that way.
All right, mate. How are you, mate?
How are you?
Good to see you, all right?
Yeah, I'm good.
Thanks for doing this.
No worries.
Still ain't got a clue what I'm doing, but it seems to be going well. And everyone seems to be saying yes.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, that's what they said to me. Do you want to do this thing with Eddie? And I was like, what the fuck does he know about it?
Exactly.
And he said, actually, he's number one on iTunes. I was like, well, hello, hang on a minute.
I was at Ascot yesterday, mate. If I get another question about Anthony Joshua.
Oh, really? Yeah, it was a huge shock, though, wasn't it? It was like, I didn't even bother. What I got up the next morning, and as I was eating my breakfast, it didn't come on the news, and I was like, fucking hell.
I was standing in the betting line yesterday at Ascot, and this bloke's talking to me about Anthony Joshua, and his wife goes, she was like a horsey lady. Mm. Not in looks, but in terms of what she liked. So she's like, she goes, can I ask you a question? Was that staged? I was like, what do you mean, was it staged? Well, you know what, though?
It could be the best thing that ever happened to him.
I think so, because at the end of the day, I wouldn't say he never takes anything for granted, because he works very, very hard.
But I think mindset-wise,
I don't think he had the same mindset that he had when he's fighting Klitschko, for example, when it was do or die.
Yeah.
It was just everyone saying you're going to deal with this fat guy easy, then you're going to fight Wilder.
It can be a good thing when you go punch on the fucking nose once in a while. It can be a good thing.
And actually, the American experience, I mean, I remember when you were there with Ricky a couple of times. It is a great buzz over there.
Brilliant. It's the best. Well, Ricky's a different thing altogether, because it's like joining the circus.
Ricky was like, the difference with Ricky, why he was a one-off, I mean, the support in terms of the numbers are quite similar, but Joshua appeals to, like, everyone.
Yeah.
Grandmas, kids. I mean, it's the first time where there's a boxer where kids in school are going, I want to be like Anthony Joshua.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ricky was just the man of the people.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in the pubs.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, totally. But,
I mean,
I've never seen coming out of the ring when he fought, I can't remember who it was, he's got a kid pouring a can of Guinness, literally as he's in the corridor doing the thing. And then he had to go and do his drug test, and he was proper put out. And I've seen him drink Guinness with boxing gloves on after fight. It's just like, you know, like a baby.
But it's like the footballers as well.
Yeah.
You talk to, like, what we had some. We used to do a lot of poker stuff, and like Norman Whiteside would come and play the poker, and he'd tell us stories about Brian Robson and Paul McGrath, and that culture.
Well,
back then,
like, I sort of say, like, this is like, you know, Ricky got beat by two of the greatest athletes of all time. Mm. I mean, the best will in the world. Ricky's not an athlete.
No,
he's a brawler.
Yeah,
you know, and when you see him in the ring with like athletes, you just go, these guys have never touched a drop of alcohol, far less been on the piss 6 weeks ago, you know what I mean? So, you know, but that's why people love him.
Does it work that way in your industry? Like, as you get old, I mean, because...
No, you're kind of required to cane it in the music business.
But as you get older, like, I don't think the lens sort of... has changed between now, health is huge, right? I'm talking about in general. So I think kids growing up, less people are smoking, less people are drinking heavily. Yeah. I think more people are taking drugs, by the way.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But I think there is that more gym, healthy eating.
I remember when I went solo, 10 years ago, walking in the dressing room and saying, what's that thing on the end of the thing there beside the bottle of whiskey? It's like, oh, that's a Nutribullet. And I was like, what fucking hell's that? And they're like, oh, you put stuff in it and blend it. I was like what? And they're like, it's for juicing. And I was like, what are you talking about? And the juices are nuts. I've got a vegan in the band.
Yeah.
They can't eat anything.
Does that take the edge away? When we talk about Joshua, like, you take the rawness away.
Yeah.
Like, the rawness of probably you in the early days with Oasis was basically you just all having a laugh. You used to turn up and get smashed have an amazing time.
Yeah. But no, but you get older and wiser, and you can't, I always say to people now, it's like, you can't behave. When you're in your 50s, you can't behave like you were when you were 24. It's physically impossible. Mm. I was in Dublin last Sunday and was in the bar still at 7 o'clock on Monday morning, and I'm still feeling it today.
Mm.
Like, yesterday, I was as hungover, and it was on a Thursday, as I'd ever been. And this was from Sunday night.
Mm.
And back in the 90s, we used to do that every night. Mm. I'm not even joking. Every night, we got to bed at 8 in the morning, do the gig the next day, 40,000 people, wouldn't think anything of it. If I had to do a gig tonight, I'd be sweating.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So it's just that your body can't take it anymore.
Mm. Mm.
As you get older, that's it.
On this page they gave me, we've started now, by the way.
Okay.
Because we don't even have a start and a finish. We just talk. When you're bored, you go.
Right.
That's how it works here. Well, one thing reading through, I got this, and another colleague of mine sent me some stuff, which one thing that stood out, found really interesting, was that your mantra, your mindset, is about living each day in the moment and actually a day at a time.
Yeah.
And I'm a massive believer in that as well, of keeping life simple.
Yeah,
to keep yourself sane.
Yep.
Because you live in a crazy world. I mean, your world's probably not as crazy as it once was, but I just think that living in...
Well, I do think people in all walks of life tend to overthink things too much.
Agree more.
Anyway, I live in the moment. I mean, I've talked to people and they've got... I say it's mainly girls. Girls always have a 5-year plan for themselves.
Yeah.
In 5 years, I want to look like this. I want to be here, and I want to have met that guy. Just like 5 years.
Mm.
In 5 years, who know? I can't even think 5 weeks in front. Mm. I've got an office of people who plan. You know, they'll send me emails saying this is your schedule for August the 19th, and then when you kind of get a phone call saying you're supposed to be somewhere half an hour ago, you say, well, nobody told me. No, I sent you an email 4 months ago. It's like, what did you tell me 4 months ago for? Remind me the night before. But I tend not to overthink anything, not artistically, not anything in my life. I mean, it changes when you have children, because then you've got to navigate the kids getting older and all that. But for me personally, thinking about things, it won't do you any good. You know, you kind of focus on what's in the here and now, and then let the future will take care of itself.
Mm.
You know, I don't believe in overthinking anything. Do it. Worry about it later.
Mm.
You know, and there's things that I've done in the spur of the moment where I've thought, afterwards, oh, that was a bit shit, or I shouldn't have done that, or I shouldn't have said that. But I think if you're living in a moment, you're coming from a place of truth, and it's instinct, and that's what it is. And I don't... Thinking about things takes too much energy anyway, I think.
Talk about life growing up for you. This is a lot of these podcasts are basically me just interested in your life and finding out what you've done. What was life growing up for you? I've read the research, but I want to hear it from you. I mean, how does a young kid from a Manchester council estate become a rock star? How does a young kid, forget where they're from, forget what kind of background they've gone, go on and end up becoming a successful few in the music business?
Well, growing up it was the same as everybody else on our estate. It wasn't, you know, everyone at some point was on the dole. I left school in 1983, so there was a point in the mid to late 80s where not only me and all my friends were on the dole, but their dads were on the dole too. Mm. So you'd go and sign on, and you'd be going and sign on with your dad, which is, at the time, you didn't think anything of it. But, you know, people make gritty dramas about that kind of shit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But at the time, we didn't think anything of it. So I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and it was way more sexist than it is now, way more misogynistic. Men were men. Men were violent, you know what I mean? The unemployment. It's only looking back on it that you think... I mean, I never thought it was difficult at all. Do you know what I mean? You were just living your life day by day. And I was obsessed with music and Top of the Pops and all that kind of thing. I never used to look in the mirror with a tennis racket and think, oh, I want to be on Top of the Pops like Mark Bolan. That, to me, that was just a thought that never occurred to me until Liam asked me to join his shitty little band. You know what I mean? It was just like... It never occurred to me. And... So I never had huge, great, big dreams.
So he had the band.
Well, he growing up, I was always into music and clothes and all that. I was going to gigs. I thought that my destiny somehow lay in music, but I didn't know what it was. I couldn't play an instrument at the time. I could play, but it wasn't really any good. Then I met a guy by chance at a Stone Roses gig, a very early Stone Roses gig. And I ended up being a roadie for his band, and they became successful. So I ended up travelling the world, and I thought, oh, this is it. Mm. This is great. I was getting like a few hundred quid a week, all the crisps you could eat, drugs, everything. Didn't have to do any interviews. Nobody knew who I was. This is great. I was on tour in Germany, in Munich, and I called home. And I was talking to my mum about whatever, and I said, how's the other fella? And she said, oh, he's out rehearsing. And I was like, what? He's not joined the Royal Shakespeare Company, surely. She said, no, he's in a band. And I was like, he's in a band? And she said, yeah. And I said, doing what? She went, he's a singer. I went, he's a singer? So I got back to Manchester after a month or two, and they had a gig, and I went to see them, and they were all right. And then they initially asked me to manage them, and I was like, what? And I went down to jam with them in rehearsals, and they said, do you want to join or what? And I was, yeah, all right. And that was it, and it kind of went from there. And it was only really, even then, it was only really, because I was still a roadie at the time, it was only as a laugh, something to do. It wasn't really until I wrote Live Forever that I thought, hang on a minute, there's something in this. You know, this is a great fucking song. And it was only then that I started to take a step back and think, right, you might have a shot at getting a big telly in a massive house.
what was the passion? Obviously, the passion for music was very strong for you, but what was it about music? Some people obviously want to become footballers. We talk about how boxing can change people's lives. I'm a big advocate of what it can do for your respect, discipline, but what was it about music?
Well, I mean, I'm a fan of music first and foremost, which is why I'm still fascinated by it after all these years. I still love what I do. Music is one of the most important things in life. It's the universal language of the world, you know what I mean? My songs... Now I go to South Korea, you know what I mean? The kids are, like, in tears at songs that I wrote when they were all at nurseries, you know what I mean? Work that one out. I don't, you know... But music has always been everything to me. It's always there. You know, it always made me feel good. The characters in music, when you've seen them interviewed, like the Beatles and the Stones and the Sex Pistols and Weller and all that, they were always like, oh, they're fucking cool, man. You know what I mean? Like the clothes they're wearing and all that. And, you know, to be able to play music, regardless of the success and all that, it's a privilege in itself.
Is that why you still do it?
Yeah.
Because, like, you talk about an age, you don't need to be out there touring, playing music. No. It's just a pure love for
it. Yeah, totally.
Love
I love it. I'm obsessed with it. It is, you know, rock stars of my age have usually got at least two hobbies. Like, you know, I've never had a driving license. I'm not into cars.
No, I read that.
You've never
driven?
No, I'm not into collecting art. No, never. Never. And I've got a £110,000 Jag sit in a garage that I had built for me on the premise that I was going to learn to drive one day, God damn it. But my hobby is what I do. You know, I drive my missus up the wall. You know, I'll get back after being away for 7 weeks on tour, and I'll get in and, you know, she'll find me in the morning playing the guitar at 7 o'clock in the morning. She'll be like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, God, I have everything. She's like, you've been on the road for 7 weeks. Mm. You know, how about playing football in the garden with the kids? Like, ah, they'll be all right, they'll be all right.
When you talk about touring, that must be... Because I think when you talk about the highs of an athlete or an artist or a performer, we talk about... I mean, you were there walking Ricky Hatton out. Mm. That ring walk, you know, that moment you come through the Players' Tunnel at Wembley, that moment you come out to play a gig in front of 50,000 people. Well, talk us through that. Yeah. I mean, what is that like backstage?
Well, it's funny that when you see a lot of sportsmen... I was like, oh, what's it like on stage? It must be amazing. It's like, but it's the same as you. You're performing. Although you're in a sporting contest, if you're a boxer with another guy and it's a bit more intense, or if you're in a football team, the only difference is I guess with footballers, is you're representing the fans. And if you get it wrong, they're on you. We're representing us, you know, and we're kind of required to be a bit sloppy and a bit lippy, you know what I mean, and not too professional. But it's still performing at the end of the day. And I look at footballers and boxers and snooker players and tennis players and just think, how can you, just, that would be too intense for me. Yet they, when you meet they just go, wow.
A lot of people say that's the ultimate.
Yeah.
You know, to get out there and perform in front of the crowd.
Like, well, it's like, I mean, I've, as you may be aware, I've taken a lot of drugs in my life, and that one, when you walk out on stage, is the best of them all. Mm. There's nothing quite like, you can be stood on the side of the stage feeling really pretty fucking bad. You might have flu or a cold or anything. Once adrenaline kicks in, it's all gone.
When you talk about the drugs, is it that it's just a process of the industry you're in? Is it something that is almost like in a way required to perform? Look at darts players, right? I know this is well off field.
Right.
There is a drinking culture in darts that means that every darts... I mean, we're doing the darts now. You're talking about 10, 12, 15,000 crowd. Mm. You're up there throwing at a little ball and you've got 15,000 piss people behind going, oh! A lot of them have a drink before they go out. And it's just like the standard industry norm where it's like a numbing effect where you're going out to basically perform.
All the great artists that we can think of, they weren't making all those great records on orange juice and fucking cigarettes, you know what I mean? The Beatles weren't sat around drinking tea all day. But I will say, I was taking drugs long before I was in the music business. Mm. It was just part of Manchester street culture growing up. That's the way it was. But you get more access to it in the music, or you did then in the music business. And the trick is, if you let the lifestyle overwhelm you and absorb you, you're fucked. I'm lucky in a way, and that I could just take it or leave it. Mm. I could properly get stuck in and then walk away from it, you know. To me, I've always worked backwards from the work. If the work was suffering, I'd pack it in, you know. As long as I'm doing good work, then everything's all right, you know. And you know, to be in the music business, particularly in the 90s, was like joining the circus. It was...
I bet.
It was... How old are you?
I'm just turned 40.
Right, so you were what? 20? You were 20?
Yeah,
tall, teenage.
I was growing up in music.
I mean, it was a great decade
to be
young.
But the perception... Like, I was probably 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 when you guys were, you know... And the perception was of you lot. It was like, these boys are fucking... They are absolutely smashing it, you know, in every way, you know. And it was, but in a way, that's kind of the image. When we talk about a promotional, you know, side, and I always look at the music industry, because I often say to my old man, yeah, we should be in music, you know. It's the same kind of things. Like, mate, I've heard about stories in music. Yeah. There's a story to be made about you guys touring and the stories and the business itself, because I'm fascinated by the business. I'm sure you've had good tour promoters, bad tour promoters, and you now know the business inside out. Yeah. You may end up probably don't want to do it, but a guy who knows exactly how to manage, promote, and monetize a successful band.
Well, I mean, I'm lucky in the fact that I've only ever had one manager,
right?
And you put yourselves in his hands completely, and there's never been any trouble with that. And he's very straight up guy, so he looks after all that. I haven't got a clue what's. I mean, I know the ins and outs of it, you know what I mean, but you got to trust the people that you surround yourself with. But touring further afield can be a bit tricky. There's always been offers to go to I'm going to play in India or, you know, somewhere else, but you're just like, you have to trust the people who've got instincts to just go, hang on a minute, this sounds a bit flaky. Yeah,
music's a strange one in that obviously what we do in terms of sports TV and content, You kind of know where it's being sold, and you know and understand the audience ratings, and you know where a fighter, if you talk about Anthony Joshua, that we might come back, you know, this market's increasing their spend, the ratings are really strong here in Germany and Spain, but music's something that just infiltrates naturally, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you say about Indonesia, it must have been weird going up when you go to tour.
Well, we first went to Japan, and... you know, it was looming this 6 months. It's like, we're going to go to Japan. We're like, I can't believe we're going to get to go to Japan. Someone's going to pay us to go there. And we were the biggest thing in England at the time. Getting on the plane to Japan, I was thinking, well, it'd be like, be like getting a punch on the nose off to start again, wouldn't they? It was like the Beatles arriving. Yeah. It was unbelievable. There were thousands of people at airports, outside hotels. It was worse when we got there than it was in England. And this is all before social media. So kind of now, with social media, you can control, not control it, but you can kind of gauge what the reaction is going to be, because you've got people, your digital experts in the office who know all this shit. Back in the 90s, you kind of threw it out there and just went, right, well, let's go and let's see what happens, you know. And it's exciting. Yeah, I get the music business is forever changing. Mm. See, what you do is kind of, you know, the two guys and there's a narrative between the two guys. And if the narrative's good and they can both sell it, you're onto a win, like Frotch.
Yeah. Groves.
Yeah. Couldn't have got a better narrative than that. And then some of them are bigger than others, and some of them are kind of, this guy's not really good at selling him, and that guy with the good fighters. You kind of know what you're getting into. Music, it's like, you know, you can put out one album one year, and then the next year do the same album by the same guy writing the same songs, and it completely bombs. Mm. And you're just like, scratch your head for years thinking, why is that? And it's just, there's a lot of variables, and it's art, and it's different, and it's people in a different way. Like when it's a pay-per-view thing, you know, Anthony Joshua Ruiz, that's not pay-per-view, but the next one is.
Yeah.
The next one is a must-see fight. Yeah. But the other one was, I'm not waiting up to 4 o'clock in the morning to see that.
And yeah, thanks for that.
It's the same with Tyson Fury's fights, you know what I mean? He's like the equivalent of parking the bus in a football match. He's like playing for the draw, seeing if we nick it. I won't stay up to 4 o'clock to watch him. Mm. But when he fights Wilder, or he fights AJ, you're staying up, you know. Mm. So it depends on the two guys in the ring. Mm.
And from there, High Flying Birds. Did you ever feel that, because you didn't start Oasis, that this was something you wanted to do, create a band? I mean, I've only just learned from our conversations that you joined that band for Oasis.
Yeah.
High Flying Birds, different kettle of fish.
Yeah, I don't. You know what it was? I left Oasis, and then I didn't do anything for 2 years, and I mean, I'm a songwriter by trade, and I had loads of songs. And it was my missus who we were sat. I was going to bed one night, not even remotely thinking. I didn't think I'd retired. But I wasn't planning on doing anything. And it's my missus who said, she's just done that thing where she said, can I ask you a question? And I was like, go on. She said, what are you going to do? And that signified to me that I'd been in the house too long. And I was like, I don't know, I hadn't thought of it. And she's like, you should do something though, which really means is I'm getting bored of you being around the house all day now. And then I woke up the next morning and I thought, right, well, I'll put a band together then. And it was just a slow process of doing that. And then I made a record, and the record was great. And if the record hadn't have been great, you know, I don't know whether I'd have put the band together and gone on tour. And then, you know, it was just a gradual thing. We did a couple of gigs, and we did a couple of bigger gigs, and the next thing was selling out the O2, and it was like, oh, right, well, it's taken off now. So there was just...
Do you feel a lot more passionately about that group than you did about Oasis back in the day?
No, exactly the same. The same. Oasis was my life, and this is my life now. And I'm older now, so I'm more considered about my approach to this, and I'm kind of in charge, and I'm the singer and all that. Whereas in Oasis was all about the struggle. It was about the struggle from growing up to getting there, and then the struggle staying there when everybody's pulling in a different direction, and you kind of got to make it work. This is just serene, and it's like, you know, I've managed to get a load of people who are all on the same page, you know, everybody's pulling in the same direction. Although I've got three girls in the band, and that is a fucking minefield. Oh my God, it's insane.
In what way?
Oh, three girls in a band, two of them fucking French. Fucking, no, they don't give a fuck. Fucking, I've never seen so many cigarettes in my fucking life.
With the changing culture, you were saying about, you know, you can create one thing one year and then next year and no one's interested. Yeah. Do you have to think about that when you're making music, or is it just because you can be stubborn, can't you, and say, no, I only do what I like.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you've got to create interest and you've got to sell albums.
I think towards.
When you talk about Black Star Dancing,
yeah,
again,
well, I will get
completely different. Well, to
one of the reasons why it wasn't that much of a struggle to leave Oasis was we'd allowed ourselves, and I was as guilty of it as anyone, of allowing ourselves to be dictated to by our audience. They wanted stadium rock, right? And we thought that was it. And we were kind of giving them, every time I would sit to write a record, it was giving them what they wanted. But towards the end of Oasis, I was like, there's got to be more to that. I was getting restless and bored with the music. And now I just trust my instincts. And if it sounds good to me, I've got by on, I pick all the singles in Oasis, and I've got by on my taste running that band for that year. So more or less, I've got it right. So when I'm in the studio and I've come up with Black Star Dancing and I like it, I think, right, well, I know everyone's not going to like it, but perversely, part of me wants to put that out just to piss a few people off. And I think, well, if I like it, a healthy percentage of people are going to like it. And you've just got to trust your instincts. You know, you'll be the same with when things take off in the boxing world. Or, you know, who'd have thought that first Frotch Groves fight, you know, would, you know, make the second one the thing that it was.
No, it was supposed to be an easy fight.
But it was when, I remember seeing Carl Froch, right, at the GQ Awards leading up to that fight, and I was saying, why are you fighting him? And he was like, oh, I don't know, you know, kind of thing. But then when they started doing the head-to-head things, it was like,
just chilled, just worked. And it was actually the first guy who really got under his skin.
Yeah.
And he really did get and then he done his head.
And then he put him on his arse in the first round. It was just like, I remember at home going, fucking hell, it's on here. It's on. And then they got the second fight was just, you know, you just print tickets, couldn't you?
Yeah.
You could print tickets.
But that was a similar thing where we talk about, I remember for the Wembley fight, I went to a few stadiums and then I went to Wembley and I walked out through the players' tunnel and I was just thought, I've got to do it here.
Did you think you could do the full 90?
No, because I spoke to my dad and I said, Dad, I've just been to Wembley. I said, this is where we've got to do it. And he's like, son, don't go mad. Once I did Eubank against Watson, the first fight was controversial.
Yeah.
I did the second fight at White Hart Lane. We sold 18,000 tickets and I lost a load of money.
Wow.
He said, don't think this fight is bigger than it is. I said, and at that time, British boxing wasn't at a level that it is now.
Yeah.
You know, Joshua wasn't doing 80,000, 90,000 that. This was like, no one had done more than 20,000.
Yeah.
And we just went in, the capacity's 80,000. And I remember going on sale, just thinking, probably like how you felt when you went to Japan, thinking, oh, what's going to happen here? And it was just bang, and it was literally an hour before virtually the whole thing sold out. And it was just, but you know, sometimes it's about creating those moments and those nights.
Yeah.
And I think same way with an Oasis gig, it was a must-see event. It didn't really matter where it was, how much it was, where you had to sit. It was just, we had to be there.
Yeah.
And that's the key of any great event, isn't it?
I remember being taken to Nebworth on the way to a gig in Southampton we were doing at Southampton, either Civic Hall or Guildhall. It was about 1,800 people, right? And on the way, they take me to Nebworth. And in the middle of this nothingness, might as well be in the middle of the desert, they were saying, so we're going to thinking of putting you on here. And I was like, where, though? And they were saying, well, here. And I was saying, but where's the stage going to be? And they're going, well, it's going to be down there. And I was like, that's not even in the same county. What are you talking about? And we kind of walked around, and I was going to the promoter, who's been my promoter all my life, Simon Moran. I was like, mate, if you're daft enough to do it, right, I'm daft enough to turn up. And he said, we could do five nights here. And I was like, you fucking out of your mind. I've got a Southampton playing 1,500 people. You're talking about 250,000 people. He said, you can play to 4 or 5 million people if you want. And because you're in your little travelling bubble and there was no social media, you had no comprehension of what it was on the outside. You were just in, you had like a core of like 8, 9, 12 friends and you all kind of hung out with each other and that was it.
How nice, by the way, is that world without social media?
Brilliant.
I mean, my old man says to now, he says, oh, I'd hate to promote now. I said, why? I said, we used to do a show. And I'd go, that was great. And then we'd go and get something to eat. And you'd be there with your mates going, what a great night.
Yeah, yeah,
now
yeah.
you do a show, and it's like, I want my money back. Yeah, you're a con man. Fuck you, Hearn.
Why do they always boo you when they get in the ring?
I don't know where it comes from.
Is it because you set the ticket price?
Yeah,
probably.
I have to go along with it now. And when I go to America, they're like, hey, Hearns. They'll call me Eddie Hearns. I love it when they boo. Why do they boo you, man? I'm like, oh, it's like a joke thing, you know, like it's just a really British thing, you know. But that world of social media, are you active on social media?
No, not at all.
No,
I don't know. I was on, when it first blew up, I was on Instagram for about a year, and then I was just bored of
negativity.
I don't read the comments. It's just I did a world tour, and it was. I'm quite a private person. I'm not interested in people seeing what socks I'm wearing, or like, you know, taking a photograph of a croissant and going fucking breakfast. Anybody? That's fuck that. I don't want anybody to know anything about me at all. I'm not interested in people seeing the real me. Fuck everybody else. I'm not interested. So when I had an Instagram account, I was literally posting a picture of the Eiffel Tower saying, thanks for coming to the gig last night, guys, and say some shitty fucking thing in French. And that was all right for the first time I did it. When I did it the second time, I was like, nah, this is boring now. And people were like, yeah, but, you know, you like do other stuff. And I was like, it's not for me. I'm not, you know...
But what was that fame like, though, being in... I mean, obviously, now you've still got it, but those days, I mean, you wouldn't have been able to...
No,
move.
I couldn't go out. It wasn't an overnight thing, and it was a gradual thing, and it was something that I was prepared for. And I've never... Going back to what we said right at the beginning, I've never overthought any of it. I always thought at some point it would level out, you know. But when kids were hanging out outside my house in Primrose Hill, the neighbours complained about the litter, right? So the council put in two litter bins outside my house, into the concrete, and they put a bench outside my house for kids to sit on. And there was never any point where there was less than 25, 30 people there. But I kind of loved it. If I'm in a bad mood and I'm in trying to buy underpants, and people are going, can I get a selfie? Just like, let's buy these first, right?
Are you good like that?
If you're a girl, you're going to get a picture, right? If you're a big idiot with an England top on saying, well, mate, can I just get a quick picture? Just go, well, I don't know, can we? You know, do you know how to work that fucking thing you've got in your hand? And they're always fanning about with it, and then they pass it to their mate who drops
turn it around.
And all that kind of shit. And I try and be as unapproachable as possible. Because you literally, if you're walking up Oxford Street and the key is not to stop. If you stop, you're fucked. Carry on walking. Just carry on moving. And but if it's girls, it's kind of like, oh, fair enough. But if it's a big fucking Geordie, it's just like, fuck off, mate. Ah, weird man, I bought all your records. Like, really? Well, nobody buys records anymore, so you've streamed them all, have you? Well, fucking good for you.
Talking about streaming, well done for bringing us on to that. I'm probably classed as a younger promoter. I am 40. When you talk about the way people are digesting content now, I mean, now...
Even that phrase.
Yeah. Yeah.
Digesting content.
Digesting content. I got it from a meeting earlier. But are you on board with that, the way people are digesting content now? Because you talk about Top of the Pops days. It's a completely different way.
Do you know what? It's although nobody buys records in any significant quantities, a lot of people now, more people go to gigs because there's so many kids at my gigs, and I mean children, who were... all the gigs I've done this year, I've looked out on the crowd every night, guys with their tops off, singing and crying at the same time, and I'm thinking, mate, you must have been 10 when we broke up, far less when we were together. And that's because they don't have to go and find your records. They just whip out their phone, and their older brother says, you want to get to Oasis, mate, that's what you want me into. And they just go, oh, that's my dad's music. They listen to it and they go, actually, fucking hell, that's all right. So it's revolutionised the live scene. But the flip side of that is, tickets are now so expensive because records are free virtually almost, and you're not going to give up your lifestyle.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But I was against it at first, and I thought it was the enemy, and I always like to own records and all that, but it's just a big tidal wave now that you just got to get with it. You know what I mean? And that's it. And there's more stuff, there's more promo to do now for like you know, you used to do a couple of interviews in music magazines, one in the press, and you'd be done. Now it's like you've got to do something for Spotify. Fucking Eddie Hearn wants a podcast. Like,
you must
Eddie
be
Hearn.
Saying, oh, if you do
Eddie Hearn's wants a chat. Fucking hell. You got to do a music. And it's like you've got to do this, and you've got to do that, and you've got to do this, and you've got to spend 5 minutes doing that, and then you need a picture for this. But you've just got to adapt. And, you know, there's not many
you
people...
You have more patience now for that.
You've got to be into it, and you've got to think, right, well, this is what I've got to do to remain doing what I'm doing, you know. And it'd be easy enough just to be an old curmudgeon about it and go, I've had enough, and just go and retire and do, you know, 6 gigs every 4 years. But I fucking love what I do. Mm. I love what I do. And
do you think that's the same for other huge acts? I'm talking about, like, the Rolling Stones. What do you think motivates the Rolling Stones? I mean, is just purely money? Is it just they love?
No, it can't be money. I know those guys. It cannot be money because they've got all the money in the world.
Don't they travel like individually to gigs?
They've been doing gigs that tours that have grossed $500 million for the last 30 years. They're not short of liquidity. They do it because they love it.
Yeah.
When I speak to Keith Richards and Ronnie Woods, I talked to two teenagers about guitars.
Amazing, isn't it?
Mick Jagger, if he's not Mick Jagger, what's he doing? He's the same as me. He doesn't drive. He can't swim. You know what I mean? He's Mick Jagger. He's going to be Mick Jagger till the day he dies. Paul Weller, you know, he's obsessed with music and where it's going and his own thing and all that. And I'm from that school where it's like, what else am I going to do? I can't do anything else. I'm not interested in anything else apart from Sarah, the kids, city, and music, and that's it. That's it. I don't care about anything else. I don't want to be an actor. I'm not asked about owning paintings. I don't really particularly into films or going out to the theatre.
For someone that lives by the moment and day to day, is it a silly question to ask you what the future holds for Noel Gallagher, High Flying Birds? I mean, is there a plan? I know you're not planning to.
I know I'm on tour until November, and then I'm just building a recording studio, so I've got to get that up and running in 2020, and then once that's done I'll make a record. But there's no hard and fast plans, you know. I've got to kids are going to move into new school soon, so I've got a bit of family life's going to take over for 2020, and which is great because I've done 3 years back to back now, so I'll spend a bit of time at home. But other than that, it's not. Plans will get fucked up really quickly in the modern world because, you know, you can start out on a cycle of making a record. By the end of the time you've made the record, all the rules have become obsolete. You know, someone will send you into the studio and say, we need 18 tracks, we need 10 for an album, we need 2 for Spotify. Eddie Hearn wants 2 for his podcast.
You know,
Asda want one. You know, by the time you get to finishing it, you've done 18 tracks and they say, yeah, no, we don't need 18 now, we just need 6. You know, so you're just like, well, I think you told me 4 months ago, and they're like, yeah, that's all changed. Eddie's not into music now. Eddie's into jujitsu.
Well, it sounds like High Flying Birds is the future for Noel Gallagher. But, mate, honestly, genuinely, I absolutely loved that. It was fantastic.
Oh, thank you very much, mate.
I appreciate sitting down with us and talking with this crazy thing we've got going. I don't know where it's going. How many episodes have we got left?
5 more. 5.
Have I got a new deal? Seriously, because when we talk about money,
you want to start streaming it. You want to start streaming it?
No, we're working on that, mate. Thanks for everything. I appreciate it. On all these occasions, I'm a little bit nervous because what I liked about Noel was basically he said I have to do all these promotional things. I've got to sit down with you and talk to your podcast. I mean, what's all that about? What does he know about music? And he was the first person that said that. Because I'm normally the guy, if I'm representing AJ or an athlete, I'm normally the guy who's dealing sometimes with a big interview, and I know what the athlete's saying, which is, what is this thing again? So you can imagine, what is this Eddie, that knob who does the boxing? No, it's good, it's rating well. It's good for the album. Oh, what does he know about boxing? Oh, sorry, about music. Nothing really, but, you know, it's something to do. So, and he was quite funny about that, you know. And this was one of the first interviews that we've done so far where he actually engaged with us quite a lot. And he was talking about, you know, Frotch Groves, talking about AJ and stuff like that. He's a massive boxing fan.
He loves it.
He does. But, you know, I really liked his attitude. I'm really honoured to sit down with these people. And Noel Gallagher, you know, I'm like a fan almost, sitting down with these people. Not just a Noel, but all of them, because... The story about Oasis is amazing when you listen to him telling it, how these lot from Manchester just got together and basically took over the music world. But I found a really bright, intelligent guy, someone with a great attitude to life, and always say about keeping it simple. You know, living the moment day by day. Don't worry about the next year, don't worry about your problems next week. Deal with today. And that's a great way in life to simplify things. When you're struggling, or when you got, you know, you're feeling a bit negative or you're depressed, deal with the day in front of you. Don't worry about the future, because you've got to live day by day. And I have to say, with all due respect to all my other guests that I've sat down with so far, this is my favourite.
So what's happening next, Eddie? What are you doing after this fight?
So we got your call tonight, and then got a really rare weekend with the family this weekend, which tomorrow involves taking my daughter to gymnastics, then going to watch Secret Life of Pets 2. Oh, I can't wait for that one. That's an all-time classic. Sunday is my nephew's third birthday. I'll be around there. And then early next week, we're off to LA for meetings. And then to Providence, Rhode Island, where Demetrius Andrade will defend his WBO middleweight world title. Joseph Parker on the card as well. Cal Yafai, British world champion, defending his title. That's on next Saturday night. And then we fly back Sunday. And then the week after that, we've got a show in Manchester. Manchester Arena, July the 6th. And then after that, we're around. And then after that's the massive O2 show with Dillian White against Oscar Rivas, Derek Chisora against Spilka, and a big British heavyweight clash between Dave Allen and Dave Price. So we've got a real busy couple of weeks.
Sounds it. It'll be good fun.
This has been No Passion, No Point with me, Eddie Hearn. Don't forget, subscribe on BBC Sounds and let us know what you thought. Give us a review.
You heard the man. Please give us a review and subscribe. And remember, you can always get in touch over Twitter, at BBC5Live. No Passion, No Point is produced by Andy Goddard. It is a BBC Studios production in association with TalentWorks for BBC Radio 5 Live. See you next time.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.